Of course, French mothers aren't just different because they're thin. Not all of them are, anyway. And I meet American women who fit back into their pre-pregnancy genes by the 3-month mark, too. But I can spot these American mothers from a distance in the park just by their body language. Like me, they're hunched over their kids, setting out toys on the grass while scanning the ground for choking hazards. They're transparently given over to the service of their children. What's different about French moms is that they get back their pre-baby identities, too. For starters, they seem more physically separate from their children. I've never seen a French mother climb a jungle gym, go down a slide with her child, or sit on a seesaw, all regular sights back in the United States and among Americans visiting France. For the most part, except when toddlers are just learning to walk, French parents park themselves on the perimeter of the playground or the sandbox and chat with one another, though not with me. In American homes, every room in the house is liable to be overrun with toys. In one home I visited, the parents had taken all the books off the shelves in their living room and replaced them with stacks of kids' toys and games. Some French parents store toys in the living room, but plenty don't. The children in these families have loads of playthings, but these don't engulf the common spaces. At a minimum, the toys are put away at night. Parents see doing this as a healthy separation and a chance to clear their minds when the kids go to bed. Samia, my neighbor, who during the day is the extremely doting mother of a 2-year-old, tells me that when her daughter goes to bed, "I don't want to see any toys. Her universe is in her room." It's not just the physical space that's different in France. I'm also struck by the nearly universal assumption that even good mothers aren't at the constant service of their children, and that there's no reason to feel bad about that. American parenting books typically tack on reminders for mothers to have lives of their own, but I frequently hear American stay-at-home mothers say they never use babysitters because they consider all childcare to be their job. In Paris, even mothers who don't work take for granted that they'll enroll their toddlers in part-time childcare in order to have some time alone. They grant themselves guilt-free windows to go to yoga class and to get their highlights retouched. As a result, even the most harried stay-at-home moms don't show up at the park looking frazzled and disheveled, as if they're part of a separate tribe. French women don't just permit themselves physical time off. They also allow themselves to mentally detach from their kids. In Hollywood films, you know instantly if a female character has kids. That's often what the film is about. But in the French romantic dramas and comedies I occasionally sneak out to watch, the fact that the protagonist has kids is often irrelevant to the plot. In one typical French film, Les Regrets, a small-town schoolteacher rekindles a love affair with her former boyfriend, who comes back to town when his mother becomes ill. During the film, we're vaguely aware that the schoolteacher has a daughter, but the little girl appears only briefly. Mostly, the movie is a love story, complete with steamy sex scenes. The protagonist isn't supposed to be a bad mother. It's just that being a mother isn't part of the story. In France, the dominant social message is that while being a parent is very important, it shouldn't subsume one's other roles. Women I know in Paris express this by saying that mothers shouldn't become enslaved to their children. When Bean is born, one of the main television channels runs a talk show most mornings called Les Maternelles, in which experts and parents dissect all aspects of parenting. Right afterward, there's another program, We Are Not Just Parents, which covers work, sex, hobbies, and relationships. Of course, some middle-class French women lose themselves in motherhood, just as some American mothers manage not to, but the ideals in each place are very different. I'm struck by a fashion spread in a French mother's magazine featuring the French actress Géraldine Pélas. Pélas, 39, is a real-life mother of two who's posing as different types of moms. In one photograph, she's smoking a cigarette, pushing a stroller, and gazing into the distance. In another, she's wearing a blonde wig and reading a biography of Yves Saint Laurent. In a third, she's wearing a black evening gown and impossibly high feathered stilettos while pushing an old-fashioned pram. The text describes Pélas as an ideal of French motherhood. She is at her base, the most simple expression of female liberty, happy in her role as mother, avid and curious about new experiences, perfect in crisis situations, and always attentive to her children, but not chained to the concept of perfect mother, which, she assures us, does not exist. There's something in this text, and in Pélas's bearing, that reminds me of those French mothers who snub me in the park. In real life, they mostly aren't prancing around in Christian Louboutin heels. But like Pélas, they signal that while they are devoted mothers, they also think about stuff that has nothing to do with their kids and enjoy moments of guilt-free liberté. Pélas, of course, shed her baby weight the instant her kids came out. But that inner life, which we glimpse in the photos, and which I see in those French moms at the creche and in the park, is also required to keep her looking and feeling seductive. Pélas doesn't look like a cartoonish MILF. She just looks like a sexy, relaxed woman. I can't imagine her telling me that she's only as happy as her least happy child. I consult my friend Sharon, who's a Francophone Belgian literary agent married to a handsome Frenchman. She's lived all over the world with him and their two kids. Sharon immediately homes in on another thing I'm seeing in the Pélas pictures and in the mothers all around me in Paris. For American women, the role of mom is very segmented, very absolute, Sharon says. When they wear the mom hat, they wear the mom clothes. When they're sexy, they're totally sexy, and the kids can see only the mom part. In France, and apparently in Belgium too, the mom and woman roles ideally are fused. At any given time, you can see both. Chapter 8. The perfect mother doesn't exist. Here's something you might not know. Spending 12 hours a day at the computer, stress-eating chocolate M&Ms, does not promote weight loss. It does, however, enable me to finish my book, and the mere presence of this book on Amazon.com jolts awake the woman in me. So does the book tour. I travel to New York, sans husband and child, to talk about the book to anyone who'll listen, and stare lovingly at it in bookstores. One salesman has seen this behavior before. He approaches me and asks, "Are you the author?" My real transformation happens when the book comes out in French. After years of having a semi-detached presence in Paris, I'm suddenly thrust into the national conversation. The book is a journalistic study of how different cultures treat infidelity. This was as far as I could get from financial writing, and it seemed like a salient topic to research from France. Americans treated the book as a serious moral inquiry. The French assumed that the book is meant to be amusing. A talk show called Le Grand Journal invites me to come on and discuss it, live and in French. I'd vaguely noticed Le Grand Journal, which is broadcast 5 nights a week at 7:05 p.m. My French publisher, a wizened woman in her 50s with a solid gold Rolodex, explains that the show is a French institution. It's a cross between The Tonight Show and Meet the Press. Host Michel Denisot is a legendary journalist. He and a panel of interviewers grill each guest. Everyone is witty, but a bit savage. It's like a posh French dinner party, but broadcast on live TV. My publisher is thrilled for the publicity, but she's panicked about my French. She arranges for me to spend hours fielding practice questions in French from a businessman she knows. He seems nervous, too. He keeps reminding me that affaire, in French, doesn't mean anything extramarital. For that, I need to say aventure or liaison. By the night of the show, I'm feeling immersed and ready. I have 3 cups of espresso and sit for hair and makeup. Then suddenly I'm standing behind 2 giant curtains. Michel Denisot says my name, and the curtains open. I descend the glossy white steps, Miss America style, then walk to a large table where Denisot and the 3-person panel are waiting for me. I'm concentrating so hard on understanding the questions that I'm not even nervous. Fortunately, they're mostly the questions I practiced. How did I get the idea for the book? How does France compare with the United States? When one of the interviewers asks me if I was unfaithful myself while writing the book, I bat my eyes coquettishly and say that I'm a journalist, so of course I was très professionnel. The interviewers and the studio audience love this. On this high note, Denisot starts to wrap up the interview. He seems to be making a summary statement. I stop paying close attention. My brother, who watches a replay on the internet, says at this point I look visibly relieved. Then suddenly I hear my name again. Denisot is formulating another question for me. He can't let it rest. It's something about was, French for Moses, and a blog. Moses had a blog? My brother says that when the camera cuts back to me, I look petrified. I have no idea what he's asking me. All at once, I get it. Denisot isn't saying blog, he's saying blague, the French word for joke. He wants me to retell a joke from my book. It's the one where Moses comes down from the mountain and says, I have good news and bad news. The good news is that I got him down to 10 commandments. The bad news is adultery is still in there. This isn't one of the questions I had practiced. On the spot, I can't think of exactly how the joke goes, and certainly not how it goes in French. How do you say mount? How do you say commandment? All I manage to say is, adultery's still in there. The audience, gratefully, is still in a good enough mood to laugh, and Denis so wisely moves on to the next guest. Despite this incident, I'm grateful to be in the working world again. It puts me in sync with French society. That's because after boldly not breastfeeding, then reconditioning their minds and bodies, French mothers go back to work. College-educated mothers rarely ditch their careers, temporarily or permanently, after having kids. When I tell Americans that I have a child, they usually ask, "Are you working?" Whereas French people just ask, "What do you do?" Back in the United States, I know lots of women who've stopped working to raise their kids. In France, I know exactly one. I have a vision of what my life as a stay-at-home mom would have been in France, when I ditch work one morning and take Bean to the park. Our local park was built in the 19th century on the site of the former palace of the Knights Templar. Take that, Central Park. This may sound like the Da Vinci Code, but really it's quite bourgeois. You're more likely to dig up an abandoned pacifier there than a medieval relic. There's a little lake, a forged iron gazebo, and a playground that fills up as soon as school lets out. Bean and I are in the gazebo when I'm jolted by the sound of American English coming from a woman with two little kids. She and I are soon exchanging life stories. She tells me that she quit her job as a fact checker to accompany her husband on his year-long sabbatical in Paris. They agreed that he would do his research while she soaked up the city and looked after the kids. 9 months into the sabbatical, she doesn't look like someone who's been relishing the city of light. She looks like someone who's been schlepping two toddlers back and forth to the park. She stumbles over her words a bit, then apologizes, explaining that she doesn't often speak to adults. She's heard about the playgroups organized by English-speaking moms, but says she didn't want to spend her precious time in France with other Americans. I try not to take this personally. She speaks excellent French, and had assumed that she'd meet some French moms and buddy around with them. "Where are all the mothers?" she asks. The answer, of course, is that they're at work. French mothers go back to work in part because they can. The high-quality creches, subsidized and shared nannies, and other childcare options all make the transition logistically possible. It's no accident that French women are supposed to get their figures back in 3 months. That's roughly when they go back to the office. French mothers also go back to work because they want to. In a 2010 survey by the Pew Research Center, 91% of French adults said the most satisfying kind of marriage is one in which both husband and wife have jobs. Just 71% of Americans in Britain said this. Some college-educated women I know do 4/5, in which they stay home with their kids on Wednesday when there's no preschool or primary school. But the mothers I meet say they hardly know any women who opt to stay home full-time. "I know one, and she's about to divorce," says my friend Esther, the lawyer. Esther recounts this woman's story as a cautionary tale. She quit her job as a saleswoman to look after the kids, but then she was financially dependent on her husband, and thus less entitled to voice her opinions. She was withholding her feelings and complaints, and therefore, after a while, the misunderstandings got worse and worse, Esther explains. She goes on to say that there are circumstances when mothers can't really work, such as when a third child arrives. But she says any break from work should be for a limited time, say until the youngest is two. French professional women tell me that quitting work for even a few years is a precarious choice. If tomorrow your husband is unemployed, what will you do? Asks my friend Danielle. Hélène, the engineer with three kids, says that she'd really prefer not to work and to rely on her husband's salary, but she won't quit. Husbands can disappear, she explains. French women work not just for financial security, but also for status. Stay-at-home moms don't have much, at least not in Paris. There's a recurring French image of a housewife sitting sullenly at a dinner party because no one wants to talk to her. I have two friends who don't work. I feel like nobody is interested in them, Danielle tells me. She's a journalist in her early 50s with a teenage daughter. When the kids are grown up, what is your social usefulness? French women also openly question what their own quality of life would be if they looked after children all day. The French media has no problem describing this experience with cold-eyed ambivalence. One article I read says that for mothers, without a professional activity, the principal advantage is to see their kids grow up. But the fact of being an at-home mother brings inconveniences, notably isolation and solitude. Since there aren't many middle-class stay-at-home moms in Paris, there also aren't many weekday playgroups, storytelling hours, or mommy and me classes. The ones that do exist are mostly by and for Anglophones. There's one fully French kid in our neighborhood playgroup, but he comes with his nanny. His mother, a lawyer, apparently wants the boy to be exposed to English. I don't hear him actually speak it. The mother shows up once when it's her turn to host. She has raced back from the office, wearing high heels and a business suit. She looks at us Anglophone mothers with our sneakers and bulging diaper bags, like we're a bunch of exotic animals. American-style parenting and its accoutrements, the baby flashcards and competitive preschools, are by now cliches. There's been both a backlash and a backlash to the backlash. So I'm stunned by what I see at a playground in New York City. It's a special toddler area with a low-rise slide and some bouncy animals, separated from the rest of the park by a high metal gate. The playground is designed for toddlers to safely climb around and fall. A few nannies are sitting French-style on benches around the perimeter, chatting and watching their charges play. Then a white, upper-middle-class mother walks in with her toddler. She follows him around the miniature equipment while keeping up a non-stop monologue. Do you want to go on the froggy, Caleb? Do you want to go on the swing? Caleb ignores these questions. He evidently plans to just bumble around. But his mother tracks him, continuing to narrate his every move. You're stepping, Caleb, she says at one point. I assume that Caleb just landed a particularly zealous mother. But then the next upper-middle-class woman walks through the gate, pushing a blonde toddler in a black T-shirt. She immediately begins narrating all of her child's actions, too. When the boy wanders over to the gate to stare out at the lawn, the mother evidently decides this isn't stimulating enough. She rushes over and holds him upside down. You're upside down! She shouts. Moments later, she lifts up her shirt to offer the boy a nip of milk. We came to the park! We came to the park! She chirps while he's drinking. This scene keeps repeating itself with other moms and their kids. After about an hour, I can predict with total accuracy whether a mother is going to do this narrated play simply by the price of her handbag. What's most surprising to me is that these mothers aren't ashamed of how batty they sound. They're not whispering their commentaries, they're broadcasting them. When I describe this scene to Michel Cohn, the French pediatrician in New York, he knows immediately what I'm talking about. He says these mothers are speaking loudly to flaunt what good parents they are. The practice of narrated play is so common that Cullen included a section in his parenting book called Stimulation, which essentially tells mothers to cut it out. Periods of playing and laughing should alternate naturally with periods of peace and quiet, Cullen writes. You don't have to talk, sing, or entertain constantly. Whatever your view on whether this intensive supervision is good for kids, it seems to make childcare less pleasant for mothers. Just watching it is exhausting, and it continues off the playground. We might not stay up nights worried about how to keep our whites whiter, but you can bet we're losing sleep over why little Jasper isn't yet out of diapers, Katie Allison Grandjou writes on Babbel.com. She describes a mother she knows with an MA in biology who spent the previous week, the whole week, teaching her child to use a spoon. That biologist surely questioned her own sanity, too. We American mothers know that parenting this intensively has its costs. But like the parents who asked Piaget the American question, how can we speed up the stages of a child's development? We believe that the pace at which our kids advance hinges on the choices we make and on how actively we engage with them. So the cost of not spoon training or narrating a trip down the slide seems unacceptably high, especially when others are doing it. The standard for how much middle-class mothers should engage with their kids seems to have risen. Narrated play and intensive spoon training are expressions of the concerted cultivation that the sociologist Annette Leroux observed among white and African-American middle-class parents. These parents see their children as a project, Leroux explains. They seek to develop their talents and skills through a series of organized activities, through an intensive process of reasoning and language development, and through close supervision of their experiences in school. My decision to live in France is arguably one giant act of concerted cultivation. My project is to make my kids bilingual, international, and lovers of fine cheese. But at least in France, I have other role models, and there are no gifted kindergartens. In America, doing concerted cultivation doesn't feel like a choice. To the contrary, the demands seem to have crept upward. A friend of mine who works full-time complained to me that she's not just expected to go to her daughter's soccer games, she's also supposed to attend the practices. Elizabeth, a French mother living in Brooklyn, was surprised that American parents were so invested in their children's success at sports. She writes that she had to repeatedly change the date and time of her 10-year-old's birthday party to accommodate the match schedules of his American friends. Each American mother described her own child's presence at the match as indispensable and claimed that without him or her, they might lose. The American push to excel often begins before kids can walk. I hear about a mother in New York whose one-year-old had at-home tutors in French, Spanish, and Mandarin Chinese. When her child was two, the mother dropped the French but added lessons in art, music, swimming, and some sort of math. Meanwhile, the mother, who'd quit her job as a management consultant, was spending most of her time applying to 24 preschools. Such stories aren't just the province of a few extreme New Yorkers. On a trip to Miami, I have lunch with a particularly sane American mother I know named Danielle. I had thought that if anyone could resist the lure of the frenetic family, she could. She's level-headed, warm, and in a city where people tend to closely follow trends in jewelry, decidedly non-materialistic. She spent part of her childhood in Italy, speaks three languages, and is generally comfortable in her own skin. She also has an MBA and a resume full of high-powered marketing jobs. Danielle dislikes overzealous parenting. She's horrified by a mother in her neighborhood whose 4-year-old son already takes tennis, soccer, French, and piano lessons. Danielle says this mother is extreme, but simply having her around makes everyone anxious. You start thinking, this kid's doing all that stuff? How is my kid going to compete? And then you have to check yourself and say, that's not the point. We don't want him competing with someone like that. Nevertheless, Danielle has found herself sliding into a practically nonstop schedule with her own four kids. The youngest are twins. In a typical week, her 7-year-old, Juliana, has soccer on Tuesday and Thursday afternoons, communion class on Wednesday, brownies every other Thursday after soccer, and a playdate on Fridays. Once Juliana gets home, she has 2 hours of homework. Last night she had to write a folk tale. She had to write a mini essay on how Martin Luther King changed America, and she had to study for a Spanish test, Danielle says. Recently, Juliana said she wanted to take an after-school ceramics class, too. And me, feeling guilty because there's no art at the school, said, okay, let's do ceramics. The only day she had free was Monday. Juliana's whole week is now booked, and Danielle has 3 other kids. The logistics of making sure everyone gets to where they need to be at the correct time has been the best use of the skills I acquired in operations management class in business school, she says. Danielle acknowledges that she could simply cut out all these activities, except for soccer. Her husband is the coach. But what would her kids do at home? She says there'd be no other children around in the neighborhood, since they're all out doing activities too. The net result is that Danielle hasn't gone back to work. I always thought that when my kids got to elementary school, I could get a full-time job again, she says. Then she apologizes and rushes off to her car. The fact that the French state provides and subsidizes childcare certainly makes life easier for French mothers. But when I get back to France, I'm struck by how French mothers make their own lives a lot easier, too. The French equivalent of a playdate is that I drop off Bean at her friend's house, then I leave. My Anglophone friends assume I'll stay the whole time. French parents aren't curt, they're practical. They correctly assume that I have other stuff to do. I sometimes stay for a cup of coffee when I return for the pickup. It's the same at birthday parties. American or British mothers expect me to stick around and socialize, often for several hours. No one ever says it, but I think part of why we're there is to make sure our kids are comforted and okay. But by the time a child is 3, French birthday parties are drop-offs. We're supposed to trust that our kids will be okay without us. Parents are usually invited to come back at the end for a glass of champagne and some hobnobbing with the other moms and dads. Simon and I are thrilled whenever we get invitations. It's free babysitting, followed by a cocktail party. In France, there's an expression for mothers who spend all their free time schlepping their kids around, maman taxi. This isn't a compliment. Natalie, a Parisian architect, tells me that she hires a babysitter to bring her 3 kids to all their activities on Saturday mornings. She and her husband go out to lunch. When I'm there, I give them 100%, but when I'm off, Natalie tells me. Virginie, my diet guru, gets together most mornings with a group of moms from her son's elementary school. I join the group one morning and mention extracurricular activities. The temperature at the table immediately rises. Virginie sits up and speaks for the group. You have to leave kids alone. They need to be a bit bored at home. They must have time to play, she says. Virginie and her friends aren't slackers. They have college degrees and nice resumes. They're devoted mothers. Their homes are full of books. Their kids take lessons in fencing, guitar, tennis, piano, and wrestling, weirdly called catch in French. But most just choose one activity per school term. One of the moms at the cafe, a pretty Zoftic publicist, like me, she's trying to pay more attention, says she stopped sending her kids to tennis lessons or anything else because she found the lessons constraining. Constraining for whom? I ask. Constraining for me, she says. She explains. You bring them, and you wait for an hour, then you have to go back and pick them up. For music, you have to make them practice at night. It's a waste of time for me, and the children don't need it. They have a lot of homework. They have the house, they have other games at the house, and there are 2 of them, so they can't get bored. They're together, and we go away every weekend. I'm struck by how these small decisions and assumptions make daily life different for French mothers. When they have moments to spare, French mothers pride themselves on being able to detach and relax. At the hairdresser, I tear out an article from an issue of French Elle, in which a mother says that she loves taking her 2 boys to the old-fashioned merry-go-round near the Eiffel Tower. While Oscar and Leon try to catch the wooden rings, I spend 30 minutes in pure relaxation. I usually turn off my cell phone, and I just space out while I'm waiting for them. It's like a deluxe babysitter. I know that merry-go-round well. I usually spend my half hour there waiting to wave at Bean each time she comes around. It's no coincidence that so many French mothers seem to parent this way. The let-them-be principle comes straight from Françoise Dolto, the patron saint of French parenting. Dolto very clearly argued for leaving a child alone, safely, to muddle about and figure things out for herself. Why does a mother do everything for her child? Dolto asks in The Major Stages of Childhood, a collection of her remarks. He's so content to deal with things himself, to pass the money in getting dressed by himself, to put on his shoes, so happy to put on his sweater backwards, to get tangled up in his pants, to play, to rummage around in his corner. So he doesn't go to the market with his mother. Well, too bad. Or even better. On Bastille Day, I take Bean to the grassy field in our neighborhood park. It's filled with parents and their young kids. I'm not narrating Bean's play, but I don't really expect to have a chance to read the three-week-old magazine that I brought along for myself, along with a giant sack of books and toys for her. I spend a lot of the day helping her play with the toys and reading to her. On the next blanket over is a French mother. She's a thin, auburn-haired woman who's chatting with a girlfriend, while her year-old daughter plays with, well, not much of anything. The mother seems to have brought just one ball to amuse her daughter for the entire afternoon. They have lunch, and then the little girl plays with the grass, rolls around a bit, and checks out the scene. Meanwhile, her mother has a full adult conversation with her friend. It's the same sun and the same grass, but I'm having an American picnic, and voila, she's having a French one. Not unlike those mothers back in New York, I'm trying to cheer Bean on to the next stage of development, and I'm willing to sacrifice my own pleasure to do that. The French mom, who looks as though she could buy a fancy handbag if she wanted to, seems content to let her daughter awaken all by herself, and her little girl evidently doesn't mind at all. All this goes a long way toward explaining the mysteriously calm air of French mothers I see all around me. But it still doesn't tell the whole story. There's a crucial missing piece. That ghost in the French mothering machine is, I think, how French women cope with guilt. Today's American mothers spend much more time on childcare than parents did in 1965. To do so, they have cut back on housework, relaxing, and sleeping. Nevertheless, today's parents believe they should be spending even more time with their kids. The result is enormous guilt. I see this when I visit Emily, who lives in Atlanta with her husband and their 18-month-old daughter. After I've been with Emily for a few hours, it dawns on me that she has said, "I'm a bad mother," a half dozen times. She says it when she caves into her daughter's demand for extra milk or when she doesn't have time to read her more than two books. She says it again when she's trying to make the little girl sleep on a schedule and to explain why she occasionally lets her cry a bit at night. I hear other American moms say, "I'm a bad mother, too." The phrase has become a kind of verbal tic. Emily says, "I'm a bad mother," so often that, though it sounds negative, I realize that she must find the phrase soothing. For American mothers, guilt is an emotional tax we pay for going to work, not buying organic vegetables, or plopping our kids in front of the television so we can surf the internet or make dinner. If we feel guilty, then it's easier to do these things. We're not just selfish, we've paid for our lapses. Here, too, the French are different. French mothers absolutely recognize the temptation to feel guilty. They feel as overstretched and inadequate as we Americans do. After all, they're working while bringing up small children. And like us, they often aren't living up to their own standards as either workers or parents. The difference is that French mothers don't valorize this guilt. To the contrary, they consider it unhealthy and unpleasant, and they try to banish it. "Guilt is a trap," says my friend Sharon, the literary agent. When she and her Francophone girlfriends meet for drinks, they remind each other that the perfect mother doesn't exist. We say this to reassure each other. The standards are certainly high for French moms. They're supposed to be sexy, successful, and have a home-cooked meal on the table each night. But they try not to add guilt to their burden. My friend Danielle, the French journalist, co-authored a book called The Perfect Mother Is You, La Mère Parfaite, C'est Vous. Danielle still remembers dropping her daughter off at her crèche at 5 months old. I felt sick to leave her, but I would have felt sick to stay with her and not work, she explains. She forced herself to face down this guilt, and then let it go. Let's just feel guilty and go on living, she told herself. Anyway, she adds, reassuring both of us, the perfect mother doesn't exist. What really fortifies French women against guilt is their conviction that it's unhealthy for mothers and children to spend all their time together. They believe there's a risk of smothering kids with attention and anxiety, or of developing the dreaded relation fusionnelle, where a mother's and a child's needs are too intertwined. Children, even babies and toddlers, get to cultivate their inner lives without a mother's constant interference. If your child is your only goal in life, it's not good for the child, Danielle says. What happens to the child if he's the only hope for his mother? I think this is the opinion of all psychoanalysts. This separation can go too far. When French Justice Minister Rachida Dati went back to work 5 days after giving birth to her daughter Zora, there was a collective gasp from the French press. In a survey by the French edition of Elle magazine, 42% of respondents described Dati as too careerist. There was less controversy about the fact that Dati was a 43-year-old single mother and that she wouldn't name the father. When we Americans talk about work-life balance, we're describing a kind of juggling where we're trying to keep all parts of our lives in motion without screwing up any of them too badly. The French also talk about l'équilibre, but they mean it differently. For them, it's about not letting any one part of life, including parenting, overwhelm the rest. It's more like a balanced meal, where there's a good mix of proteins, carbohydrates, fruits, vegetables, and sweets. In that sense, the careerist Rachida Dati had the same problem as stay-at-home moms, a life too heavily weighted toward one element. Of course, for some French mothers, l'équilibre is just an ideal, but at least it's a calming ideal. When I asked my Parisian friend Esther, who works full-time as a lawyer, to assess herself as a mother, she says something that I find breathtaking in its simplicity and the lack of neurotic tension. In general, I don't doubt whether I'm good enough, because I really think I am. Inès de la Frassange isn't an ordinary French woman. In the 1980s, she was Karl Lagerfeld's muse and main model at Chanel. Then de la Frassange was asked to be the new face of Marianne, the symbol of the French Republic, who appears on stamps and on busts in town halls. Past Mariannes have included Brigitte Bardot and Catherine Deneuve. De la Frassange and Lagerfeld parted ways after she accepted. He allegedly said he didn't want to dress a monument. Now in her early 50s, de la Frassange is still a doe-eyed, languid brunette whose long legs don't seem to fit under café tables. She's had her own eponymous fashion label and occasionally still walks the runway. In 2009, readers of Madame Figaro voted her the best embodiment of the Parisian woman. De la Frassange is also a mother. Her two equally leggy and photogenic daughters, the teenaged Nine and tween-aged Violette, have already launched their own fashion and modeling careers. De la Frassange used to make light of her own charms by calling herself the swarthy asparagus. She says she's an imperfect mother, too. I forget about morning yoga, and I always put on lip gloss and mascara in the car mirror. What's important is to rid yourself of guilt over not being perfect. Obviously, de la Frassange isn't typical, but she incarnates a certain French ideal about striking a balance. In an interview with Paris Match, she describes how 3 years after her husband died, She met a man at a ski resort in the French Alps where she was vacationing with her daughters. The man just happened to be the head of one of France's most important magazines, and a recipient of the French Legion of Honor. De la Fressange wasn't Lagerfeld's muse for nothing. She put off her suitor for a few months, explaining that she wasn't ready. But as she tells Paris Match, "Finally, it was me who called him to say, 'Okay, I'm a mother and a working girl, but also a woman. For the girls, I thought it was good to have a mother in love.'" Chapter 9. Caca Boudin. When Bean is about 3, she starts using an expression I've never heard before. At first I think it's caca Buddha, which sounds like it could be vaguely offensive to my Buddhist friends. As in English, caca is a French kid's term for poop. But after a while I realize she's saying caca Buddha. Buddha means sausage. My daughter is going around shouting, if you'll pardon my French, poop sausage. Like all good curse words, caca Buddha is versatile. Bean shouts it gleefully when she's running through the house with her friends. She also uses it to mean, whatever, leave me alone, and none of your business. It's an all-purpose retort. Me: what did you do at school today? Bean: caca Buddha. Snortle. Me: would you like some more broccoli? Bean: caca Buddha. Hysterical laughter. Simon and I aren't sure what to make of caca Buddha. Is it rude or cute? Should we be angry or amused? We don't understand the social context, and we have no childhood experience of our own in France to draw on. To be safe, we tell her to stop saying it. She compromises by continuing to say it, but then adding, "We don't say caca Buddha. It's a bad word." Bean's budding French does have perks. When we go back to America for Christmas, my mother's friends keep asking her to pronounce the name of her hairdresser, Jean-Pierre, with her Parisian accent. Jean-Pierre has given her a pixie haircut that they coo is oh so French, too. Bean is happy to sing, on demand, some of the dozens of French songs she's learned in school. I'm amazed the first time she opens a present and says spontaneously, "Oh la la!" But it's becoming clear that being bilingual is more than just a party trick or a neutral skill. As Bean's French improves, she's starting to bring home not just unfamiliar expressions, but also new ideas and rules. Her new language is making her into not just a French speaker, but into a French person. And I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that. I'm not even sure what a French person is. The main way that France enters our house is through school. Bean has started École Maternelle, France's free public preschool. It's all day, 4 days a week, except for Wednesdays. Maternelle isn't compulsory, and kids can go part-time, but pretty much every 3-year-old in France goes to maternelle full-time and has a similar experience there. It's France's way of turning toddlers into French people. The maternelle has lofty goals. It is, in effect, a national project to turn the nation's solipsistic 3-year-olds into civilized, empathetic people. A booklet for parents from the Education Ministry explains that in maternelle, kids discover the richness and the constraints of the group that they're part of. They feel the pleasure of being welcomed and recognized, and they progressively participate in welcoming their fellow students. Charlotte, who's been a teacher at maternelle for 30 years and still charmingly has the kids call her maîtresse, teacher, or literally mistress, tells me that in the first year the kids are very egotistical. "They don't realize that the teacher is there for everyone," she says. Conversely, the pupils only gradually understand that when the teacher speaks to the group, what she's saying is also intended for each of them individually. Kids typically do activities of their choosing in groups of 3 or 4, at separate tables or parts of the classroom. To me, maternelle seems like art school for short people. During Bean's first year, the walls of her classroom are quickly covered in the students' drawings and paintings. Being able to perceive, feel, imagine, and create are goals of maternelle, too. The children learn to raise their hands, à la française, with one finger pointed up in the air. I was worried about enrolling Bean. The creche was a big romper room. Maternelle is a bit more like school. The classes are big, and I've been warned that parents get very little information on what goes on. One American mom tells me she stopped asking her daughter's teacher for feedback after the teacher eventually explained, "If I don't say anything, that means she's fine." Bean's first-year teacher is a glum woman whose only comment about Bean the entire year is that she's very calm. Bean adores this teacher and loves her classmates. And despite all the painting and drawing, there's a lot of emphasis on learning to follow instructions. Bean's first year, I'm jarred to see that the whole class usually paints exactly the same thing. One morning, there are 25 identical yellow stick figures with green eyes hanging up in the classroom. As someone who can't write anything without a deadline, or two, I recognize the need for some constraints. But seeing all those nearly identical pictures is unsettling. Bean's second-year artwork is more freeform. It takes me a while to realize that in Bean's classroom the first year, there isn't even an alphabet on the wall alongside all the artwork. At a meeting for parents, no one mentions reading. There's more fuss about feeding lettuce to the classroom's tank of escargot, tiny ones, not to be eaten. In fact, as I'll discover, kids aren't taught to read in maternelle, which lasts until the year they turn six. They just learn letters, sounds, and how to write their own names. I'm told that some kids pick up reading on their own, though I couldn't say which ones, since their parents don't mention it. Learning to read isn't part of the French curriculum until the equivalent of first grade, the year that kids turn seven. This relaxed attitude goes against my most basic American belief that earlier is better. But even the most upwardly mobile parents of Bean's school friends aren't in any rush. "I prefer that they don't spend time learning to read now," Marion, herself a journalist, tells me. She and her husband say that at this stage, it's much more important for children to learn social skills, how to organize their thoughts, and how to speak well. They're in luck. While reading isn't taught at maternelle, speaking definitely is. In fact, it turns out that the main goal of maternelle is for kids of all backgrounds to perfect their spoken French. A booklet for parents produced by the French government says this French should be rich, organized, and comprehensible to others. That is, they need to speak it much better than I do. Charlotte, the teacher, tells me that children of immigrants typically enter maternelle in September speaking bare-bones French, or none at all. By March, they're usually competent, if not fluent. The French logic seems to be that if children can speak clearly, they can also think clearly. In addition to polishing their spoken grammar, the government's booklet says a French child learns to observe, ask questions, and make his interrogations increasingly rational. He learns to adopt a point of view other than his own, and this confrontation with logical thinking gives him a taste of reasoning. He becomes capable of counting, of classifying, ordering, and describing. All those philosophers and intellectuals I see pontificating on evening television in France apparently began their analytical training in preschool. I'm grateful for the maternelle. I haven't forgotten that my friends back in the United States, even if they're not buying baby literacy DVDs, are battling to get their kids into private preschools that can cost $12,000 a year for just half-day sessions. I meet a mother from New Jersey who drives 50 minutes to drop off her twin daughters at their preschool. By the time she gets home, she has enough time to shower and toss in some laundry before she has to go pick them up. It's not just the well-off who are overwhelmed by childcare costs. In a study showing how much money an American couple with two young kids needs for basic economic security, childcare is the top expense. The French maternelle is far from perfect. Teachers effectively have tenure, whether they're any good or not. There are chronic funding problems and the occasional shortage of places. Bean's class has 25 kids, which feels like quite a lot but isn't even the maximum. There's a teacher's assistant who helps with supplies, bathroom runs, and general wrangling. On the plus side, the only thing I regularly pay for at maternelle is lunch. The cost is on a sliding scale ranging from 13 cents to 5 euros per day, based on parents' income. The school is a 7-minute walk from our house, and the maternelle makes it very easy for mothers to work. It's in session from 8:20 to 4:20, 4 days a week. For another small fee, there's a leisure center on the premises that can look after kids until the early evening and all day on Wednesdays. The leisure center is also open on many school holidays and during much of the summer, when they take the kids to parks and museums. Maternelle is clearly a big part of what's turning my little American girl into a French person. It's even making me more French. Unlike at the crèche, the other parents immediately take an interest in being, and by association, in me. They now seem to view our family as part of the cohort that they'll be traveling all through school with, whereas after the crèche, the kids scattered to different schools. A few of the mothers from Bean's class have little babies and are out on maternity leave. When I pick up Bean from school and bring her to the park across the street, I sit with some of these women while our kids play. Gradually, we're even invited over to their homes for birthday parties, afternoon goûters, and dinners. While the maternelle brings us all more into French life, it also makes us realize that French families observe social codes that we don't. After a dinner at the home of my friend Esther and her husband, who have a daughter Bean's age, Esther becomes agitated because the little girl won't come out of her room to say goodbye to us. Esther finally marches into the girl's room and drags her out.
Au revoir,
the 4-year-old says meekly. Esther is soothed. Of course I'd been making Bean say the magic words please and thank you, but it turns out that in French there are 4 magic words, s'il vous plaît, please, merci, thank you, bonjour, hello, and au revoir, goodbye. Please and thank you are necessary, but not nearly sufficient. Bonjour and au revoir, and bonjour in particular, are crucial. I hadn't realized that learning to say bonjour is a central part of becoming French. Me, my obsession is that my children know to say merci, bonjour, bonjour, madame. Audrey Guttard, the French journalist with 3 kids, tells me, from the age of 1, you can't imagine. I said it to them 15 times a day. For some French parents, a simple bonjour isn't enough. They should say it with confidence. It's the first part of a relationship, another mother tells me. Virginie, the skinny stay-at-home mom, demands that her kids heighten the politeness by saying bonjour monsieur and bonjour madame. My friend Esther insists on bonjours at the threat of punishment. If she doesn't say bonjour, she stays in her room. No dinner with guests, Esther explains. So she says bonjour. It's not the most sincere bonjour, but it's a repetition, I'm hoping. Benoit, a professor and father of 2, tells me there was a family crisis when he took his kids to stay with their grandparents. His 3-year-old daughter would wake up grumpy and didn't want to say bonjour to her grandfather until she'd had breakfast. She finally compromised by agreeing to say, pas bonjour papi, not good morning, grandpa, to him on the way to the table. He was happy with that, in the way she was acknowledging him, Benoit explains. Adults are supposed to say bonjour to each other too, of course. I think tourists are often treated gruffly in Parisian cafes and shops, partly because they don't begin interactions with bonjour, even if they switch to English afterward. It's crucial to say bonjour upon climbing into a taxi, when a waitress first approaches your table in a restaurant, or before asking a salesperson if the pants come in your size. Saying bonjour acknowledges the other person's humanity. It signals that you view her as a person, not just as someone who's supposed to serve you. I'm amazed that people seem visibly put at ease after I say a nice solid bonjour. It signals that, although I have a strange accent, we're going to have a civilized encounter. In the United States, a 4-year-old American kid isn't obliged to greet me when he walks into my house. He gets to skulk in under the umbrella of his parents' greeting, and in an American context, that's supposed to be fine with me. I don't need the child's acknowledgement because I don't quite count him as a full person. He's in a separate kid's realm. I might hear all about how gifted he is, but he never actually speaks to me. When I'm at a family luncheon back in the United States, I'm struck that the cousins and step-cousins at the table, who range in age from 5 to 14, don't say anything at all to me unless I pry it out of them. Some can only muster one-word responses to my questions. Even the teenagers aren't used to expressing themselves with confidence to a grown-up they don't know well. Part of what the French obsession with bonjour reveals is that, in France, kids don't get to have this shadowy presence. The child greets, therefore he is. Just as any adult who walks into my house has to acknowledge me, any child who walks in must acknowledge me too. Greeting is essentially recognizing someone as a person, says Benoit, the professor. People feel injured if they're not greeted by children that way. These aren't just social conventions. They're a national project. In a meeting for parents at Bean School, her teacher says that one of the school's goals is for students to remember the names of adults, Bean calls her teachers by their first names, and to practice saying bonjour, au revoir, and merci to them. The booklet by the French government says that in maternelle, kids are supposed to show their grasp of civility and politeness, including greeting the teacher at the beginning and the end of the day, responding to questions, thanking the person who helps him, and not cutting someone off when they're speaking. French children don't always succeed in saying bonjour. Often there's a little ritual in which the parent pushes the child to say it. Comme c'est bonjour! The adult who's being greeted waits a beat, and then tells the parent in a friendly way not to worry about it. This seems to satisfy the obligation, too. Making kids say bonjour isn't just for the benefit of grown-ups. It's also to help kids learn that they're not the only ones with feelings and needs. It avoids selfishness, says Esther, who dragged out her daughter, an adorable, doted-on-only child, to say goodbye to me. Kids who ignore people and don't say bonjour or au revoir, they just stay in their bubble. Since parents are dedicated to them already, when will they get the sense that they are there to give, not just to receive? Saying please and thank you puts children in an inferior receiving role. An adult has either done something for them or the child is asking the adult to do something. But bonjour and au revoir put the child and the adult on more equal footing, at least for that moment. It cements the idea that kids are people in their own right. I can't help thinking that letting an American kid slink in the door without greeting me could send off a chain reaction in which she then jumps on my couch, refuses to eat anything but plain pasta, and bites my foot while I'm having dinner. If she's exempt from that first rule of civility, she, and everyone else, will be quicker to assume that she's exempt from many other rules too, or that she's not capable of following these rules. Saying bonjour signals to the child, and to everyone else, that she's capable of behaving well. It sets the tone for the whole interaction between adults and children. Parents acknowledge that greeting someone is in some ways an adult act. I don't think it's easy to say hello, says Denise, a medical ethicist with two girls, ages 7 and 9. But Denise says it fortifies kids to know that their greeting matters to the adult. She explains, I think the child who doesn't say bonjour cannot really feel confident. Neither can the child's parents. That's because saying bonjour is also a strong marker of upbringing. Kids who don't say the French magic words risk being slapped with the label mal élevé, badly brought up. Denise says her younger daughter had a friend over who shouted quite a lot and jokingly called Denise chérie, darling. I told my husband I will not invite him back, she tells me. I don't want my child to play with children who are badly brought up. Audrey Guttard, the journalist, has written a book called Le Grand Livre de la Famille, in which she tries to upend some French parenting conventions. But even Guttard doesn't dare question the importance of bonjour. Honestly, in France, a child who arrives somewhere and doesn't say bonjour, monsieur, bonjour, madame, is a child that one rejects, she tells me. A six-year-old who doesn't look up from the TV when you come in at a France house, I'm going to say that he is badly raised. I won't say that he's normal. We're a society with a lot of codes, and this code, if you don't follow it,
You're excluded from society. It's as stupid as that. So you give your kids less of a chance to be integrated, to meet people. I say in my book that it's better that your kids know this code.
Yikes. I'd vaguely noticed French kids saying bonjour, but I hadn't realized how much rests on it. It's the sort of signifier that having nice teeth is in the United States. When you say bonjour, it shows that someone has invested in your upbringing and that you're going to play by some basic social rules. Bean's cohort of 3 and 4-year-olds has already had several years' worth of bonjours drilled into them. Bean hasn't had any. With only please and thank you in her arsenal, she's at just 50%. She might have already earned the dreaded label, badly brought up. I try to appeal to the tiny anthropologist in her by explaining that bonjour is a native custom she has to respect. We live in France, and for French people it's very important to say bonjour, so we have to say it too, I say. I coach her in the elevator before we arrive at birthday parties and at visits to the homes of French friends. What are you going to say when we walk in? I ask anxiously.
Caca Buddha,
she says. Usually, when we walk in, she says nothing at all. So I go through the ritual of, very publicly, telling her to say bonjour. At least I'm acknowledging the convention. Maybe I'm even instilling the habit. One day while Bean and I are walking to her school, she spontaneously turns to me and says,
even if I'm shy, I have to say bonjour.
Maybe it's something she picked up in school. Anyway, it's true, and it's good that she knows it. But I can't help worrying that she's internalizing the rules a bit too much. It's one thing to play at being French. It's quite another to really go native. Although I'm ambivalent about Bean growing up French, I'm thrilled that she's growing up bilingual. Simon and I speak only English to her, and at school, she speaks only French. I'm sometimes astonished that I've given birth to a child who can effortlessly pronounce phrases like carotte râpée and confiture sur le beurre. I thought that young kids just pick up languages, but it's more like a long process of trial and error. A few people tell me that Bean's French still has an American twang. And though Bean has never lived outside the Paris Ring Road, thanks to us, she evidently radiates some kind of Americanness. When I take her to her Wednesday morning music class one day, the babysitter usually takes her, I discover that the teacher has been speaking to Bean in pidgin English, though she speaks French to all the other children. Later, a dance teacher tells the class of little girls, in French, to lie down flat on the floor, comme une crêpe, like a crepe. Then she turns to Bean and says, comme une pancake. At first, even I can tell that Bean is making lots of mistakes in French and coming up with some bizarre constructions. She usually says the English for instead of its French equivalent pour, and she knows only the vocabulary that she's learned in the classroom, which doesn't really equip her to talk about cars or dinner. One day she suddenly asks me, avion is the same as airplane? She's figuring it out. I'm not sure which mistakes come from being bilingual and which come from being 3 or 4 years old. One day in the metro, Bean leans into me and says,
you smell like vomila.
This turns out to be a combination of vomit and Pamela. A minute later, Bean leans into me again. What do I smell like now? I ask.
Like college, she says.
At home, some French expressions edge out the English ones. We start saying cuckoo instead of peekaboo and gee gee when we tickle her instead of coochie coochie coo. Bean doesn't play hide and seek, she plays cache cache. We put our garbage in the poubelle. Her pacifier is a tétine. No one in our household farts. They make proutes, rhymes with roots. By the spring of Bean's first year in maternelle, friends tell me that her American twang is gone. She sounds like a genuine Parisienne. She's become so confident in French that I overhear her joking around with friends in French in an exaggerated American accent, probably mine. She likes to mix up the two accents on purpose and decides that the French word for sprinkles must be sprinkles. Me. How do you say d'accord in English? Bean.
You know,
sounding like an Alabaman.
D'accord!
My father finds the idea of having a French grandchild charming. He tells Bean to call him grand-père. Bean doesn't even consider doing this. She knows he's not French. She just calls him grandpa. At night, Bean and I look at picture books. She's excited and relieved to confirm that, as with airplane, certain words in French and English refer to the same thing. When we read the famous line in the Madeleine books, something is not right. She translates it into colloquial French, quelque chose ne va pas. Although Simon has an English accent, Bean's English sounds mostly American. I'm not sure if that's my influence or Elmo's. The other Anglophone kids we know in Paris all have their own accents. Bean's friend, the dad from New Zealand, and a mother who's half Irish, sounds full-on British. A boy with a Parisian mother and a Californian dad sounds like a French chef from 1970s American television. The little boy around the corner with a Farsi-speaking father and an Australian mom just sounds like a creaky Muppet. In English, Bean occasionally emphasizes the wrong syllables of words, the second syllable of salade, for example, and she sometimes puts English sentences into a French word order.
Me, I'm not going to have an injection, me.
Or translates literally from French to English.
Because it's like that.
She tends to say after, when what she means is later. In French, they're the same word, après. Sometimes Bean just doesn't know how native English speakers talk. In a weird appropriation of all the Disney Princess DVDs she's been watching, when she wants to know if something looks good on her, she simply asks,
"Am I the fairest?"
These are all small things. There's nothing that a summer at an American sleepaway camp won't fix. Another French word that infiltrates our English vocabulary is bêtise. It means a small act of naughtiness. When Bean stands up at the table, grabs an unauthorized piece of candy, or pitches a pea on the floor, we say that she's doing a bêtise. Bêtises are minor annoyances. They're bad, but they're not that bad. The accumulation of many of them may warrant a punishment, but just one bêtise on its own probably doesn't. We've appropriated the French word because there's no good English translation of bêtise. In English, you wouldn't tell a child that he's committed a small act of naughtiness. We tend to label the kid, rather than the crime, by telling him that he's being naughty, misbehaving, or just being bad. These phrases don't really show the severity of the act. Of course, in English, I know the difference between hitting the table and hitting a person, but being able to label an offense as a misdemeanor, a mere bêtise, helps me as a parent to respond appropriately. I don't have to freak out and crack down every time Bean does something wrong or challenges my authority. Sometimes, it's just a bêtise. Having this word calms me down.